From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a Wisconsinite adopted from Korea as a baby returns to Seoul as an adult. We'll find out why.
Then a Milwaukee area girl works to make an award-winning nature video.
Wisconsin writer Michael Perry's past books have all been memoirs, but for his latest, he channels his inner 12-year-old girl.
You can't so much create a character as let it speak through you. And honestly, things started to go more smoothly, and Maggie's voice came to me much more naturally when I just would kind of get a little bit of that dissociative state where I'd let her run the show.
And Wisconsin musician Sean Carey talks about how his background in classical percussion informs his songwriting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the percussion part of me comes out more in my songs than maybe the drummer part of me.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Laura Klunder grew up in Franklin, Wisconsin in the 1990s. She went on to college at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. In many ways, her suburban childhood was like many of her peers. But in one fundamental way, her life was different from nearly everyone she knew.
Klunder was born in South Korea and was an international adoptee who came to this country at the height of an adoption boom from that country. Today, she lives in Seoul and is a leading activist in the effort to reduce or even end the practice of international adoptions. It's a complicated issue that defies easy black and white analysis.
Her story and that of the movement of which she's a part was featured in the New York Times Magazine earlier this month. We reached her via Skype from South Korea. Laura Klunder, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, not to start this by painting with too broad a brush, but let me just ask you a big question here. What is it that brings so many Korean adoptees back from the United States to Korea?
You know, everyone has their distinct reason, but the article in the New York Times points out that many of us are back looking for a sense of connection, and that could be a connection to multiple things. It could be our country, our culture of origin, South Korea. It could be our birth families. But for a lot of us, it's a connection to each other, to other adoptees, and to establish friendships and memories with each other.
Help us understand what brought so many Koreans to the United States in the first place. I mean, obviously, you were very little when you were adopted, but what were the pressures, especially in those times in the 80s, that led to so many children entering the international adoption system?
Well, Korean adoption started in the mid-1950s following the Korean War, and there was the Holtz discussed the way that there were all these war orphans that needed a place and that there wasn't a place for them here in Korea. As Korean adoption continued for over 60 years at this point in time, more and more the issue became about the societal pressures facing unwed mothers to send their children overseas and have a better life. That was the dominant narrative in the culture. Korean women often are given messages that they're selfish to keep their children. They're given messages that their child will be better off if they grow up in the United States, where they might have access to housing, education, resources that a Korean mother cannot provide in Korea.
And it sounds so like there's both economic and societal exploitation, if you will, at work here.
Absolutely. There's a real stigma associated with unwed motherhood here in Korea. And also, women are confronted with questions about their marital status in job interviews. They may be discriminated against in the workplace if they're an unwed mother. So there's a reality of, can they raise their child economically if they are being denied access to employment?
It seems like it would be much easier to go after things like economic pressures and legal pressures than it would be to go after things like societal norms.
You know, we actually have to work on everything here. So in 2011, the special adoption law was passed by a coalition of people fighting for adoptee rights and unwed mothers' rights. KORUT, the Korean Unwed Mothers and Families Associations, Truth and Reconciliation for the Adoption Community of Korea, Adoptee Solidarity Korea, and the Public Interest Lawyers, we all worked together to work on some of the policies in Korean culture that would keep children in Korea versus sending them overseas. But then we also adoptees, unwed mothers are working together to speak out, to come out of the closet and talk about being proud to be an unwed mother, being an adult adoptee, and being in solidarity with unwed mothers in Korea.
How readily do you see people in Korea as willing to listen to what you have to say?
You know, I'm an optimist, so more and more as more adoptees come back and we talk about our experiences, I feel like Korean people are curious about our experiences as adult adoptees, and they do want to learn what can they do to help unwed mothers here in Korea. There are a lot of assumptions, and so sometimes people just really have no idea that there's so many complicated issues around adoption. Most people assume that it's a very simple story, that there's not a place for children here in Korea, and so sending them overseas for adoption means that they can have a better life. But because adoptees and unwed mothers are working together, we've been able to complicate that narrative and say unwed mothers need support from our government, they need support from society to help them raise their children here in Korea, and we can, if we work together, we can all be part of the solution.
Do you get the sense, is there any national shame associated with this? I mean, I think I read in the New York Times article that something like 200,000 Koreans were adopted internationally over the past 60 years. That is a lot of people.
Absolutely. The article cites that it's roughly the size of Des Moines, Iowa. And so more and more Korean people are saying that we want to keep our Korean children here in Korea. And if you look at the current events in Korea, there's a lot of media coverage of the low birth rate, a weak social welfare system that cannot support our aging society. And so there's actually a real necessity to keep Korean children in Korea.
Would you encourage that to take place through more, you know, in-country adoptions, if you will?
Well, I think it's complicated. For me, I feel like advocating for family preservation first is a priority. So helping women, helping unwed mothers keep their children if they want to by providing government assistance and addressing the social stigma that might coerce women to relinquish their children to adoption. If family preservation first is not an option, yes, prioritize domestic adoption over intercountry adoption. And work towards a stronger social welfare system at the same time.
How did you arrive at the decision to move to Korea? You grew up in the Milwaukee area, went to school at UW-Madison, and I think you were working in Minnesota before you moved to Seoul.
Absolutely. And even if I thought visiting Korea was something that I wanted to do, living in Korea was so beyond my imagination at that point in time. But when I... Let's see here. I was living in Minnesota. I met a number of Korean adoptees, and some of them had actually lived in Korea, and it was really surprising for me at that time. A year later, I visited Korea for the first time, and the article says that I participated in something called The Gathering. There were about 800 Korean adoptees from all over the world there. When I was at that conference, I heard other adoptees talk about living in Korea and being part of Korean society, and it just opened up my mind to think I can live in Korea, I can make friends in Korea, I can establish memories in Korea. This is something that I want for my life. It's something that I didn't have access to as a child, but as an adult, I do have that option, and it's worth it, even if it's going to be hard, and certainly there's loss associated with moving to Korea as an adult.
There's loss. There's also complications. I mean, it is a much different language. It is a much different life than you would have experienced in the Midwest.
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing easy about living here. It's only that it's worth it because I was born in Korea and I'm a Korean American adoptee. So I'm not only Korean and I'm not only American. At the same time, Korean culture is part of who I am and it's worth it to me to explore it.
Are there parts of you that still feel like an American living in Korea?
Absolutely. When I get tired and lonely, I want to eat biscuits and gravy and tater tot hot dish, and I would like to watch my weird sitcoms like Arrested Development and just other shows about white people.
Do you see your work already having an impact? I mean, are there, if not success stories, certainly things that make this gratifying?
Yeah, I want to believe that it is having an effect. You know, our group organizations worked together to pass a special adoption law in 2011. We're consistently seeing media coverage about supporting unwed mothers and family preservation. But I also think in the intimate lives of adoptees and adoptive families that we're having new conversations that say, yes, I'm so grateful for this adoptive family. Also, I feel a sense of loss and isolation because of these other power dynamics where I feel different. As a family, can we work towards our differences and then be supportive? And I think that's happening more and more. I think adoptive families are wanting to support their adoptee, and that's not about denying difference. It's about the whole family transforming and adjusting to have conversations about race, loss, grieving, and how to be a brand new family that's never existed before.
Is that the message you would want people in the United States to appreciate about your story and the story of so many others who have gone back?
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, there's a couple ways to read the story, and one could read it and feel sad that, oh, my adoptive family adopted me and now I'm back in Korea, they lost me. But I think there's a really optimistic and positive story that there are 200,000 adoptees out there, and some of us are choosing solidarity when we were isolated at various moments in our lives. And there's so much possibility that we can work together to not only make place for ourselves as individuals, but for a community of people who at times felt lost, felt abandoned, that in this moment in time, we can do something. And that can start with a conversation and listening.
I would imagine, you know, sometimes a tough message for a lot of well-meaning Americans to hear. I mean, the obvious normal narrative in this country probably is that, you know, people are presented with this image of small children living in orphanages or other situations in which it's difficult to imagine a bright future, and they see themselves in a situation to make a difference in a life. If not adoption, what would you want people in the United States who, you know, would have been considering that step, what would you want them to consider?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I've talked to a lot of people who say just what you said, I want to help. And I think one of the most effective ways to help is to support Korean unwed mothers. And the Korean Unwed Mothers and Families Association, KUMFA, who's mentioned in the article, is a group of unwed mothers in Korea who are fighting for their rights to raise their children. And so you can find them on Facebook. You can donate to them online. You can also just have conversations in your families around the dinner table at holidays about what are the issues that unwed mothers are experiencing around the world. And if women have the right to raise their children, and is there something that we can do to be more supportive than removing a child and not only saving one child by adopting them away from their family and country of origin, but helping so many children who are vulnerable because their families are denied access to economic resources and social support?
Do you talk to Korean adoptees in the United States who, for whatever reason, make the decision that they feel more comfortable staying in the United States?
Yeah, absolutely. I have adoptees and adoptee friends all over the world, and some of us do choose to come back to Korea and live here. Some of us choose to visit Korea, and some of us choose to stay in our adoptive countries, and that's totally valid. What I would hope is that adoptees, wherever they are in the world, feel like they have the choice to be part of a broader adoptee community, even if not wanting to be part of their country of origin. But I do think that adoptees create space for each other every time we get together and tell our stories to each other. I think that's really powerful.
I wonder if at the heart of all of this is the message that the concept of home is not necessarily to be taken for granted.
I think that's true. And I think that in my personal experience, home has shifted over time, and it's not a geographic location only. Sometimes it's a moment, sometimes it's with friends. And I think that adoptees have the right to define home. And when I was growing up, I didn't have that right. Someone told me what home is, and that home was Franklin, Wisconsin. And I wanted to complicate that. And now I can. And I would hope that other adoptees feel empowered to define home for themselves, that it can be one place, it can be multiple places, and it can change to surround them wherever they are.
Do you think a day will come when you will want to come back here for a visit?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure it will be in summer when the lakes are beautiful and I can go hiking and walking.
You are not missing anything as far as the weather goes right now.
Oh, no, I'm happy to be here in Korea right now. But maybe around state fair time when there's a cream puff and corn that's in question, I will be back in Milwaukee.
Well, Laura Klunder, thank you so much for spending some time with us and helping walk us through this really complex issue.
Yeah, thank you so much for being curious about us and our work here in Korea.
Laura Klunder is a representative for Adoptee Solidarity Korea, who lives in Seoul. Klunder herself was a Korean adoptee. She grew up in Franklin and graduated from UW-Madison. Her story was featured recently in the New York Times Magazine. There is a link to the story from WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now and then meet a local 9-year-old whose video on trees is a finalist in a national competition. You are listening to Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We don't often have the opportunity to hear the voices of kids on Lake Effect, but today is a happy exception. The topic has to do with nature and came to us by way of one of our contributors, Stacy Tornio. Her third grade daughter entered a national contest, Trees Rock, sponsored by Scotties, the people who make facial tissue.
Among hundreds of videos submitted by classes and individual students, the 9-year-old Edgewood Elementary student made the cut. And as we speak, people can vote online for their favorite Trees Rock entry. And of course, our guest, whom you're about to meet, hopes you like hers best.
The adult voices you'll hear will be our environmental reporter, Susan Bentz, who chatted with Ms. Tornio just inside Edgewood Elementary minutes before she headed to basketball practice. The other adult is her mom, Stacy.
My name is Annabelle Tornio.
And Annabelle, how did you find out about this contest?
My mom, she looks for contests that we can join and do. She found this one, and I think it was fun.
Did you share the idea with your class, or you just decided, I'm going to go for this, or how did that?
I just went for it.
So you were able to send in your video yourself to Scotties.
Yes.
And they let you guys know at home that you had made the cut. Right?
Yep.
How did you find out?
My mom told me. They called us.
Yeah. Tell her about your journal, though, and before you even made the video, about how you had to get ready for it.
We picked some ideas, like trees make nuts, people are nuts about nuts, and they make homes for animals. And lots more. Well, 8 more.
So your journal, you started to write down your ideas in the journal, and then did you have to send the journal to the Scotties people? Mm-hmm. Or you just used that to prepare your plan?
Prepare.
Nice. Yeah, and Anna did the journal on her own. Like, she wasn't going to enter the contest at first, were you?
Nope.
Because?
Because at first I didn't... It sounded fun to me, but I was too busy doing stuff.
Well, I was thinking, you're a sports person. You play at least a couple sports, don't you? You're about to go to basketball practice.
Yep.
And you do what, softball, or what's your other?
Softball and gymnastics and piano.
Well, so I can see where you thought you might not have time for this. So what made you decide, okay, I'm going to go for it?
I went for it because it sounded fun.
And your mom was inspiring you to go for it, maybe.
Yeah.
Annabelle likes journaling, and she has all kinds of journals all over the house that she writes notes in. And then she wasn't going to enter the contest, and then she just started journaling about it on her own and started making up reasons. I said, hey, You should try to come up with 10, and then we could turn that into a video.
Okay, so they let you know, and then what happened from there?
Then it got really exciting, and we had to give a flash drive, like, with both, because we entered two videos. Fifth grade did one all together, and I did one, so I got in, but they didn't.
But you did you took the flash drive to school so that the principal, Mrs. Sterner, could show it to the entire school.
So you and the whole school watched it together? How did that feel?
Good.
Whoa. That's exciting.
What did your friends say about the
They said the good
money.
Job. The money. They were like, whoa, when the lowest was $500.
The lowest you can win is $500.
Okay.
And they thought that was a lot.
Oh, so you're going to win something no matter what. Yeah. That's very exciting. What do you think the school could do with $500?
Well, we have a big field. We're fifth grade in.
Right, we're looking at it right here.
Yeah, right here.
Yeah.
Fifth grade and fourth grade play, and there's no trees back there except back where we cannot go.
Right.
So we want to plant some trees there and maybe some picnic tables for like an outside classroom and maybe some going for our playground fundraiser.
So have you watched the other videos that are up, you're running up against?
Mm-hmm.
What's your objective opinion?
My opinion is that some of them are funny and weird.
People will ask me, okay, Stacy, did you really do it or did you really like write the reasons? Because I'm a writer and they think that. And I really didn't. So Anna really did write them herself.
And that's a completely true statement that your mom just made?
Yes.
I remember saying to her, I'm not going to do this for you. If you want to have an entry, you have to take some initiative. And we did. It was the last day that we made the actual video.
Oh my gosh.
So
you're busy with a lot of things in your life. Where does the whole nature and either plants and animals, where does all of that fit into what you're interested in your very busy life?
We did, since it was Martin Luther King Jr.'s Day, we did a thing, I Have a Dream, because he had a dream speech. And we did that, so I write anything about nature that I have a dream, and my dream was people would stop cutting down trees.
So what have you learned through this process so far, Annabelle?
That I should be more kind to trees, even though I am.
How can you be even kinder to trees?
To not pull bark off them.
Oh, yeah, that's tempting, isn't it? That's so interesting. Yeah.
I just want to see what's behind it.
Well, you're an explorer, right? You're a scientist. Yeah. Well, where should I take your... So voting started.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you won't know what the vote is until it's all over?
They do status updates, and the first one came today, and we're behind. Anna doesn't know this yet.
What?
We're out of 10 right now, we're in 9th place. And so we're hoping that we can rally some community support and get our signs out, because we had a little slow start. We didn't have our signs out. And so we're hoping that this week we can...
9th place.
But just imagine what this radio story will do. Oh my gosh, you might go off the charts.
Right, so we're hoping in a week that we can move up a few spots. Because they do
a lot of spots.
Because it does go 500, there's a $1,000 reward, there's 2,000, 4,000. I mean, that's some...
6,000.
So we're hoping, we're trying to rally and see if we can move up some spots.
So far, this is my very last question.
Okay.
What's been the sort of the most interesting or surprising thing that's come out of this experience so far?
I'm in 9th place.
Well, that's the most current news, but before that, before your mom spilled the beans, it's hard to shake that, right?
The reasons I liked a lot.
So you're happy with all 10 of those reasons?
Yes!
What's your very toppest of those 10, if you had to choose?
Animals. They make them for animals. I need to meet some people.
Now you won't rest until this is over, right? May I take your photo somewhere?
Yeah.
Where should we do it?
Probably out by a tree.
I think you're right. You want to put your jacket on?
Nah, I'm fine.
Annabelle Tornio is a third grader at Edgewood Elementary in Greenfield, Wisconsin. She is one of 10 national finalists in the Trees Rock Contest, sponsored by Scotties. She's in the third through fifth grade category.
You'll find a link to her video, along with the rest of the national finalists, on our website. Voting ends February 6th at 11:59 Eastern Standard Time, and depending on how close you live to Greenfield, Wisconsin, you might hear Annabelle if she comes out on top.
Up next, Wisconsin author Michael Perry chats with us about his latest book, his first for kids. You are listening to Lake Effect on WUWM.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We have talked with writer Michael Perry on this show quite a few times about his nonfiction memoirs of life lived in rural western Wisconsin. Perry's attracted fans around the world, really, for his stories about working as an EMT, about parenting, about raising chickens and pigs, and growing up in an obscure Christian sect, and his friendship with and admiration for an older neighbor.
But until now, his books weren't reaching young readers. Perry's first published work of fiction is a middle-grade novel called The Scavengers, the sort of post-apocalyptic story of Maggie and her family living apart from most of the rest of society, which has moved under a mysterious bubble.
Perry's most recent visit to Milwaukee was on a tour in support of that book, and he stopped by to see us. Mike Perry, always nice to see you.
Wonderful to be here, as always.
You have written, obviously, a lot of nonfiction in your time. Was it tough for the time that you were writing this book to put personal narrative aside?
Well, of course, there's always the old question about how much of the fiction is drawn from your personal narrative, and I can address that. What was different for me was at first there was this flush of freedom where I'm not writing nonfiction, so I don't have to fact check, and if I want to go in a direction, I can go there. I don't have to worry about it. I very much enjoyed creating the characters and the environment. But I soon began to realize that this thing they call plot is a real humdinger.
It's a demanding beast,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, you'd always have to obey plot. So personal narrative certainly entered into it in some obvious ways. The protagonist is a young girl. I never say specifically, but she's around 12. And I have a 14-year-old and a 17-year-old daughters. And over the course of the time I was writing this, the 3 years passed, so I watched them through those years. And certainly, as a father of daughters, I drew from that experience. On the other hand, this is in no way intended as some sort of composite of them. Setting certainly draws from my personal narrative. You know, the title of the book is The Scavengers, and they scavenge this ravine they call Goldmine Gully that's filled with junk. And I have a ravine behind my farm that's filled with junk. So yes, and also there are parents in this book that figure pretty prominently, and part of what probably reflects personal narrative is the uncertainty of being a parent. Here they are in charge of their children, in this case, in this book, in a dangerous situation, and they have to make decisions, and they're imperfect decisions. I certainly feel that every day as a parent.
Well, and yeah, I think I probably knew better than to ask how much of you is in any of these characters and how much of your daughters is in any of these characters. But I wondered about the relationship between the parents and Maggie or Ford Falcon, and the relationship between you and your children.
Sure, there is some of that, but I have to say there's even more between Maggie or Ford Falcon. Maggie changes her name to Ford Falcon early on. There's more to the relationship between her and these other two characters who live in the valley, this octogenarian couple, Toad and Arlinda. And that was drawn from – I wrote a book called Visiting Tom about my octogenarian neighbors and Tom and Arlene. And in the book I refer to Toad and Arlinda. But I have been and continue to be so fascinated with my daughter's relationship with those elderly people and watching how they act around them and how they pay attention and how they are respectful and how they draw things in, certainly listening to them more closely than they do sometimes the old man. So, yes, I definitely drew on that relationship in creating it.
Well, and speaking as an adult reader who has read all of your previous work, or certainly much of it, it did take me a few chapters before I could read this book without hearing it in Michael Perry's voice in my head. I don't think my daughter had the same problem, but was it at all a challenge to speak convincingly as an 11 or 12-year-old girl?
It was. Two things helped. On a very fundamental level, my editor helped. She does a lot of this. And she just occasionally would take a line and say, you know, I'm not sure she would express it quite that way. And then I'd revisit it. What helped even more, and this is where I have fun at the expense of my own ego, is that for years I would make fun of my fiction writing friends because they would talk to me about how the characters inhabited them and they were merely speaking for the character. And I would always go, yada, yada, yada. And then about three chapters into this book, I just realized you can't so much create a character as let it speak through you. And honestly, things started to go more smoothly, and Maggie's voice came to me much more naturally when I just would kind of get a little bit of that disassociative state where I'd let her run the show and present the problems and just let her react in real time. And I didn't always write the first thing that came to mind, but that's how the process worked.
Did you find yourself having Maggie moments? You know, you're out doing things and you're so into that character that you experience it as though she were experiencing it?
Not so much. It's not like I'm Johnny Depp. But I will tell you what happened is that the parts where that definitely happened, any time in there where she's writing about, for instance, there are scenes where she's sitting with her mother and they're reading a book together. Well, I'm still kid enough inside that I still get excited about those memories. I remember how it felt when Mom would read to me, and it was like doors and windows to entire other worlds were opening up. And so that was pretty easy to recover. It was pretty – matter of fact, one of the tougher parts of the book is that this guy Toad speaks in a pretty complicated patois, if you will. And
full of malapropisms.
Malaprops, yeah. Spoonerisms, flip-flops and verbal mishmashes, as he says. And – right at the last minute, I started cutting all of that out and rewriting it because I was worried that it would be too difficult. And then I got to thinking about when I was a kid, I loved word challenges and word tricks and secret codes. I made my own, you know, and made the key and buried it in a tuna can. And so I stuck with it. And so far, I've been rewarded because a few adult reviewers have commented that his dialogue is a tad chewy. But I've had younger people tell me they just love figuring out what he's talking about.
Well, we have talked before about how your upbringing in a small fundamentalist Christian sect kept you from being exposed to a lot of popular music when you were young. But what kind of books were you reading when you were the age of the audience for Scavengers, which is, you know, about 8 to 12 or 13?
Well, in third grade, I read All Quiet on the Western Front. So I'm not sure where I come in on the chart there. I tapered off pretty quickly after sixth grade is what I always say. But I was reading a mix of, honestly, things like All Quiet on the Western Front. I remember in fifth grade reading Serpico. I don't know why I remember that book, but that's what I was reading.
Made into an Al Pacino movie.
Sure. And then I also read, I read piles and piles of Westerns because that's what was around the house. Louis L'Amour Westerns, Zane Grey, a lot of that stuff. The Little House on the Prairie books I read and reread now and then. But honestly, I was a pretty omnivorous little feller even that young.
The spectrum of titles wasn't limited the way the spectrum of music titles was.
No, not at all. We've spoken at greater length about my history, which is that I was raised in an obscure fundamentalist Christian sect, so no TV, no movies, no radio, that kind of thing. So popular culture I was pretty walled off from other than what I picked up during the day at school. But as far as reading, my mom took us to the library every week. She filled the house with books, poetry, prose, everything. She certainly vetted it until a certain age. But I can't say that they ever deprived me of books, and that definitely is reflected in this book.
Well, and Maggie or Ford Falcon, depending on what we should call her in mixed company, she bonds with her mother over Emily Dickinson, one of the only books that the family has taken with them. Are you an Emily Dickinson person, or is this a relationship let me stop the question there. What is Emily Dickinson to you?
I am not at all an Emily Dickinson expert. I probably have a passing familiarity with her. What fascinated me about choosing Emily for this story was the same. I feel so fortunate. I'm a from a working class farming background. The arts were not a big part of my life. And then I met at one point in my life all these weirdos in the arts, and they changed. They lit up my life. It's changed my life forever. And so I loved the idea of Emily Dickinson, who on the surface, and again, I have to stress, I'm not getting into the true complexities of her, but on the surface is this prim, reclusive person wearing the dresses, right, you know, scratching out these very tiny self-contained poems, appealing to this young girl who's rough and tumble because she has to be, makes her own weapons, survives on her wits, has got dirty, broken fingernails from scavenging, because that's kind of been my life, that art lifted me up. And I wanted also the book, you know, there's a lot of, I'm working pretty hard here on that whole idea of the strong, independent woman. And what you find out when you do read some history on Emily Dickinson is that in her time and facing what she was facing and how even her male helper was basically holding her down, she had this fierce spirit that never went out. And so I thought it would be fun for someone like Maggie to choose someone like Emily.
And moreover, I imagine it probably wouldn't be the worst thing in the world in your eyes if – you know, somebody read this book and then the next thing they did was they, you know, went and looked up Emily in the library.
Yeah, I never, because of my fundamentalist background, I never like to preach at people because I sure don't like to be preached at. And so you try to lay things in between the lines. And I will say, there, of course, there's a little bit of that. I'm hoping that, you know, there's this young reader who feels the same as me, that here I was just this kid working in the dirt on the farm, and then someone showed me this beautiful thing, and now I have both. I'm still living on a farm, driving a pickup truck and going to the feed mill, but I go to poetry readings and modern dance recitals and Shakespeare festivals. Yes, I'm hoping that there's a message there that, you know, this stuff is for all of us.
Without giving anything away, we really haven't talked much about the set of circumstances that that Ford Falcon and her family find themselves in, but they are basically in a world shortly after something really bad has happened.
Yeah, and it's not entirely clear until you get into the book. You're given two choices. You either live in one place where everything is taken care of for you and things are really pretty good, but you don't really have free will. And frankly, intentionally, a lot of what happens in that world is left somewhat behind the scenes for now because it was a two-book deal and I have to write a sequel. And then the other world is much rougher and dangerous, but you at least are choosing to do what you want to do, and that's what it comes down to. I will say that I use the phrase in the book, you're either in bubble or out bubble. And when I proposed this book, if you go back and look at the contract I signed, the proposal was that in bubble, they would actually be cities under domes. And about 2-3 months after I signed the contract, Stephen King released Under the Dome. And I told my editor, I said, well, first of all, no one's going to believe that I came up with this on my own. And secondly, Steve's lawyers are just so much better than mine.
So, yeah. So we don't really have the perfect picture in our minds of
– We don't. And also that, again, reflects more – that situation reflects – I wanted the book not to have a lot of easy answers because I watch my daughters. You know, not everything resolves like it's an after school movie. And in fact, at the end of the book, Maggie makes a difficult decision, and I'm not sure that everyone will be happy with it. But it seemed to me that that was the decision she would make, knowing what we know about her character.
You do come down kind of hard on politicians and corporations in this book, and this is not always a topic that the middle graders get into.
No, and again, I loop back to what I always say about I have changed my mind profoundly on some subjects, coming from being a fundamentalist Christian to the whatever sort of knucklehead I am now. But, you know, not one of those major changes, and we're talking 180 degrees here on some things, none of them came because someone preached at me, none of them came because someone hectored me, and none of them occurred because I read the right bumper sticker. It was just a matter of time and being around the right people. And so I do get into some of the political, corporate things that are going on, but they're, again, I hope portrayed in such a way that you kind of make up your own mind. I mean, I'm a self-employed guy, so you know, I'm all about the free market. I'm out there swinging, but I also wanted to examine some of the more difficult issues, but do it in a way that I hope. Oh, you know, the other thing is, speaking as a dad. Who for the last 11 years has been ingesting a lot of books, movies, and other media made for young people. We all know the best ones are the ones that address the audience at hand, but then you lay a little humor and maybe a little thought in there for the adult in the room. Yeah.
Well, and really, I think it's clear that you're guarding against pontificating.
Yes, it's one of my least favorite things ever. And we're all guilty of it to some point. But yeah, I do try to hold back. And this whole book is about a young, independent woman. And with the word independent comes the idea that she will make up her mind about everything, which indeed she does.
Well, we are glad, as always, to have you here and come back and see us again. Mike Perry, thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Wisconsin writer Michael Perry's latest book is a middle grade novel called The Scavengers. He's also author of several books for grown-ups, among them Visiting Tom, Truck, A Love Story, and Population 485, Meeting Your Neighbors One Siren at a Time. He was in Milwaukee last fall.
We'll take one last break, and then we'll chat with Wisconsin singer-songwriter S. Carey ahead of his concert at the Cedarbrook Cultural Center tomorrow night. So stay tuned. Lake Effect continues right after this. Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Sean Carey's path to becoming an acclaimed indie singer-songwriter started very close to his native Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Carey has taken his interest in classical and jazz percussion and used it as the basis for his current music making, which he performs under the moniker of S. Carey.
Carey plays everything from marimba to organ to guitar on his latest album called Range of Light, but he gets some help from fellow Eau Claire musician Justin Vernon, with whom he played as part of Vernon's Bon Iver project.
Carey will play at the Cedarbrook Cultural Center tomorrow night. I first reached him by phone last spring and wondered then if his degree in classical percussion from UW Eau Claire ever had him imagining a career with a symphony.
No, not at all. I mean, I guess there was always that possibility, but no, I guess at that point I thought I would just be more of a gigging musician and probably go teach private lessons and stuff or maybe go to grad school. I wasn't quite sure. I definitely didn't picture myself being a touring musician and ultimately, you know, being a songwriter either. So
yeah, where did that transition happen? You know, a lot of people are gigging musicians, but making that shift is kind of a big one.
Right. Well, my last semester at college, I started to play with Bon Iver, and that was kind of getting a lot of attention. And basically right after I graduated, we hit the road for about a year and a half. So that's when it started. And then over that year and a half, 2 years of being on the road and seeing the world and being exposed to a bunch of their new music and seeing bands play, and it was just really inspiring to me, and I kind of felt this wave of creativity inside me, and I wanted to get that out, so I started working on my first record called All We Grow, and that's when S. Carey started.
Range of Light is the new album, and with the songs we're hearing today kind of weaving in and out are from that album. And when I listen to the tunes that I've heard, I'm really struck by the fact that you were a percussionist to start with, because the songs are in some way so rhythmically driven. The future. I'm thinking of Crown the Pines, particularly because, yeah, it's very melodic and there's a lot of interesting harmonies going on, but the way you've layered those vocals is incredibly rhythmic.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think that the percussion part of me comes out more in my songs than maybe the drummer part of me. Some of the songs are kind of like anti-drummer, you know, like, where we don't use a full kit and try to layer different textures of percussion with shakers and wooden sounds. And then we also try to use more pitch percussion like vibraphones and piano and anything like that that creates layers of percussion. And that's something that definitely I took from my classical training, whether playing in percussion ensemble at school or even just checking out more modern composers that really explore percussion, especially in the last 50 to 75 years. But yeah, I guess that's kind of one of my main springboards for writing, is kind of creating cool textures like that and using percussion as the basis to write a song on top of.
You're radiant and I'm ready for to bring a flower in. And the sun was up and the frost was gone. And in that dewdrop dress of fawn, and the spots were on, but I'm calm this run.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you started with, you know, sort of a rhythmic idea first. You know, a lot of songwriters would start with a melody or maybe a lyric or something like that. Do you usually start with that idea of a rhythmic complexity and something you want to explore that way?
It depends, I guess. Yeah, I mean, with Crown the Pines, I just had that main motif right away, that that the vocals and the piano and bass all are doing in unison, and that's where that song started. And but every song is kind of a little different, I feel like. And Justin Vernon actually helped because he sings on that song, and he helped kind of clarify what the vocals should be doing as far as those the layers of more of the choral, almost round sounding vocals.
Yeah,
so that was really cool.
I was thinking it was like counterpoint. You had all of these really fabulous, almost anti-rhythmic things happening all at the same time, but it all worked.
Right, yeah.
And so you're crediting him? You're not taking credit for that?
Well, I think he came up with the line that he sang, and then basically, we worked on the song for quite a while, and we had all the like undercurrents. We had all that going on, and then he popped in, and we were kind of at this stopping point. And I had some lyrics laying around that I wanted to use, but I just couldn't figure out how to use them in a longer melodic way over the top of all the faster rhythms. And so, yeah, Justin definitely helped me with that melody and kind of had that idea to do the more round choral thing on that song.
I am in love with this place, but I fear for its gray shoot. The sky opens up like the sea, and the resilience of
I'm
the things that my boss and I thought of when we were listening to it is that that's what the Beach Boys would sound like now if they were recording now.
Yeah, that's a compliment. I was a huge Beach Boys fan as a kid, actually. So.
Oh, well, you can tell. You can tell that's in great. That because that is we just looked at each other and said, are you sure that's not the Beach Boys? You know, kind of like morphed a little bit, but certainly you can hear the influence in that. And California, California plays such an important role in this album in general, not just Beach Boys. You talk about California and Arizona influences. How did that come about?
Well, my dad is from California, so his whole family, my whole side of the family is from there and still lives there. And my dad actually lives in Arizona now. But we would go out and visit every summer and spend like a month driving around those states and camping and hiking. And we went to Yosemite and went to the Grand Canyon and went to a bunch of places that are so wildly different than Wisconsin. So I just kind of have always had a love for the West and for that area specifically, and some of the songs, when I started writing them, I started to tap into those memories of visiting those places. And even more recently, too, I mean, just every time we're out there on tour, I just have a lot of history there. I proposed to my wife in San Francisco, and it just makes me feel warm and
Well, Sean, it has been such a pleasure talking with you, and welcome home.
Thanks.
Eau Claire native Sean Carey's new album is called Range of Light. We're hearing a track from it called Never Ending Fountain.
Carey will play a concert tomorrow night at the Cedarburg Cultural Center. There's a link to more information from WUWM.com. That's all the time we have for the Friday edition of the program. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend and be back here again Monday morning at 10 for Lake Effect.
It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. The latest news comes your way in just about an hour on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. But right now it's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned because Fresh Air is next. We'll be right back.